Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very excited to welcome you to part two. Part two. Is that how we say it? Do? Do? All right. Part two of our fabulous Talmud Tuesdays exploration of Tractate Pesachim. This is the tractate all about the holiday of Passover. And the reason why we're studying this now is, as you might have guessed, because Passover is nary a few weeks away. I don't know if I use nary correctly in the sentence, but it is what it is. So that's
one question.
Yes, Marnin.
Is it 370-419 or is it 370-419?
370-419. No dash. No dashes. Okay. So here we go. Pesachim.
Hillel says there's a dash. Shammai says no dash.
You know what? Sometimes you gotta go by. Wait, who says no dash? I forgot again. I'm sorry. Okay, so here's what we're learning. We're learning Pesachim, and I want to tell you this. What I'm gonna do is let's mute everybody and unmute yourself. I'm gonna mute everybody. Unmute yourself to ask any questions. To add to the conversation, but for the sake of keeping the background noise at a low level, so the default will be muted. Now, I hold in my hands a copy of this tractate, the Steinsaltz edition, as you can see. It's known as, it's called the Koran Talmud Bavli, not to be confused with the Koran, that's something else. This is still Talmud, this is still Jewish, and this is still the way we like it. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to share my screen with you in a moment. I want to jump in. I want to kind of introduce what we did last week. Last week, we studied the Mishnah and the opening of the Gemara of the tractate. So the Mishnah basically tells us that the evening of the 14th day of Nisan is when we check our houses for the chametz. There's a prohibition in the Torah on Passover. The Torah tells us, do not eat chametz. But not only is consumption problematic, even having it or seeing it is problematic. So any chametz in our possession is a no-no. Now, there are ways, which we'll talk about, there are ways in which it can still be in our homes and it's not ours, i.e. if we sell it, but before we get there, this is the beginning of the exploration. So the Mishnah begins by saying that on the eve of the 14th of Nisan, that's when we check our homes for the chametz. The implication being, whatever we find that shouldn't be there, we're meant to get rid of it, as we'll see soon, the next day. The phraseology of the Mishnah uses the phrase Ar La'arba Asar, translated as the evening of the 14th, but the Hebrew word is Ar, and Ar usually means light. So the Talmud asks the question, what's up with that? And I'm paraphrasing. Basically says, what's the deal with the word "ar" light being used to mean evening? Evening is not light. Light is not evening. Hey June, good to see you. So good to see you. So what is the meaning of the word "ar"? What is the meaning of the word light? And we had an elaborate discussion, or we started discussing it. The Talmud discussed it in a very elaborate way. The bottom line is that R means light, but it can also be a euphemism for evening. Why is it euphemistically used for evening? The short answer is because the Mishnah did not want to begin with a word of foreboding. It didn't want to begin with, it was dark, it was a dark and stormy night, and then check your chametz. It didn't want to begin on a dark note. So it begins on a light note. So it says, the light of the 14th, and we know it means the evening of the 14th, i.e. the night before. Even though it's a time of darkness, still it euphemistically uses the word ar. And the Talmud derives a beautiful life principle, and that is, if you have a choice, and even if maybe you don't have a choice, always use nice language. Use uplifting language. Use positive language. Don't opt for the scary, foreboding, negative language. You are, Steve, you are hypnotizing me with that eye. I'm getting sleepy. Right, the positivity bias. The Rebbe was an incredible role model of this Talmudic adage and Talmudic dictum, this teaching from the Talmud, which is a person should always speak belush and nikiya, with clean words and not negative words. Not scary words, not dark words, not ugly words, not evil words. Although I literally just said all these negative words. But the point is to not say them and to use nice words whenever possible. Now, it's possible that a person cannot be clear unless they say the negative word, and then you have to say it. But otherwise, if at all possible, it's always preferable to say the clean word. In fact, the Talmud, as we jump in right now, the Talmud tells us that there were instances where, based on a person's choice of words, the sages of the Talmudic era were able to discern the moral quality of a person. A person that consistently used negative language, something's up. Something's not so kosher with that person, as we shall see. Right now, I'm about to share my screen. You do not need to have your own copy of the Talmud, although if you do, you can. But we're using, again, the Steinsaltz translation. This is from Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who is a scholar who is still alive. He's an elderly scholar. He's a tremendous Talmudic scholar and other scholar in Israel. And we're using his recently published English translation of the Talmud. So here we go. I'm about to share my screen. And you can see it for yourselves in uno momento. All right. Tell me if you see it. You got it? You got it? All right. It works. Now, let's start at the top. This is Psachim 3b. Remember, it starts on page 2a. So we've done about a page and a half of Talmud. Each page is an A and a B side. So it's 2a, 2b. 3a, and now we're up to 3b. We did about a page and a half last week. We didn't do every single passage. We kind of skipped around or summarized a little bit, but we did most of it. Now let's jump right in. The Gemara, can you see where I'm highlighting on the page? Can y'all see that? Okay. Oh, and by the way, like I mentioned last time, let me close that. Like I mentioned last time, it's very important. If you have any questions, any ideas, anything you want to share, please unmute yourself and ask. It's not meant to be a monologue. It's meant to be a dialogue. This is Talmud study. It's meant to be interactive. Okay, so let's jump in. The Talmud relates an incident involving the use of appropriate language. This is a great story. There were these two students who were sitting before Rav. Now, Rav was one of the rabbis, but he was such a great rabbi that they just called him Rav, and everyone knew who they were talking about. So, two students were sitting before Rav and were weary from studying a complex issue. Their brains were very tasked with all the study. One of them said, "This halacha we are studying is rendering us as tired as a tired misankan. Oh, tired, the Hebrew, the word here for tired, let's go up to the Hebrew, or to the Aramaic. Oh, kedavar acher, yeah. Misakna, misankan. So it's as a tired something else, which is a euphemism for a pig. So, like we say, like a chazer, you ever heard the phrase a chazer? A pig. So, in Amalek HaTzaitin, they used to call it a davar acher, something else. Like, they wouldn't even say the word pig or chazer. They would just say something else. So this one student says, "Oh, I feel like a tired something else," i.e. a pig. And the other one said, "This halacha is rendering us as tired as a tired kid," like a kid goat. Rav would not speak with that student who made reference to a pig, as one who speaks inappropriately is undoubtedly flawed in character. So that was it. He was done. You reference a pig, you're out. It's in Rav's court. Again, the point is not, you know, what one strike and you're out. We can analyze this and whatever. The point is that using negative language or ugly language, or let's say it positively, not using kind language is an indicator of something perhaps negative. Let's continue. The next story is also interesting. The Gemara additionally relates that there were these two students. The bold words are the original words of the Talmud, and the unbolded words are the ones that are kind of making it all work together. That's why it references the Gemara, even though this is the Gemara, the Talmud. The Gemara edition relates that there were these two students who were sitting before Hillel. You see, Steve, here, Hillel, and one of them was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and some say, we have a different, two versions of the story, some say these two students were sitting before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and one of them was the Amora, Rabbi Yochanan. So, two versions of the story, which rabbi, senior rabbi was there, and which of the students was there. Either way, one of them said, due to what reason need one be careful to harvest grapes in a state of ritual purity by insisting on the use of pure vessels? Bop, bop, bop. And one need not harvest olives in a state of ritual purity. Let me explain what's going on here. With regards to ritual purity and impurity, the halacha is, the law is, that something can only become ritually impure if there is some water involved. Now, to be very clear here, water doesn't make something impure. Water is just water. But if somebody touches something and they're in a state of impurity, what helps it transfer is the presence of liquid. Liquid helps impurity transfer. That's one of the ingredients of the transfer of impurity. So what the halacha is, here's the law. If you're harvesting grapes or harvesting olives, there's a different law. So if you're like olives grow on an olive tree, right? Yeah? You heard about the one, there were two olives in a jar and one fell out. And the other one said, are you all right? Are you okay? And he said, olive. Okay. So, yeah, I can, although you're all kind of, your mics are muted, I feel the, just the uproar, that just the explosion of laughter. It's actually better because I can imagine it and not hear the sad, you know, maybe, possibly, you know, who knows. Okay, but getting back to this. So if you're harvesting olives or grapes, there are different laws. When it comes to grapes, if there is liquid, if when you pick the grapes, there is liquid, you know, like when you grab a grape and some of the juice, some of the liquid comes out of the grape. If you are collecting the grapes, collecting the clusters, and putting it into a bowl that's in a state of ritual impurity, your grapes become impure because the bowl is impure and there's liquid. That's it. You're done. You messed up your grapes. You had grapes. You put them in an impure vessel and there's liquid from the grapes. No good. But if the same thing would happen by olives, if you would pick olives and put them into an impure vessel and there was a little bit of the juice of olives, it's still fine. It's still kosher. It's kosher either way, but it's still considered to be a state of purity, not impurity. The question that these students were wondering is why? What's the difference between the grapes and the olives? Why by grapes does the liquid render it impure, whereas by olives, it remains pure? And by the way, I'll tell you the answer, because the point of this Talmudic piece is not actually the answer. The point is how these two students phrased the question, as we'll dive into in a moment. What language they use to ask the question. I'll give you the answer. The answer is because the juice, the Talmud says, in a different place, the juice of grapes is considered to be something that could be used, for example, for grape juice. But when you take olives and a little bit of juice or oil, whatever it is, squeezes out, you're not really going to use it. That's what it says. Whereas by grapes, the liquid is considered to be a liquid. By the olives, you're not going to use it anyway. You're going to discard it. You know, it's insignificant. That's what it says. The juice of the olive, you know, born of just handling it, is insignificant, so it's not considered to be a liquid, whereas the juice of the grapes born of handling, that is considered significant on some level, at least for the farmer, and therefore it can render it impure. Let me say, I see I have some comments here in the chat. Let's look at the chat. David, sour grapes. Stephen, language is okay. This is fantastic. All right, I'm glad I read these. These are fantastic. If you don't know about the chat, so you want to jump into the chat because that's where apparently all the fun is happening while we're studying Talmud. Now let's jump in. What Michael is asking. What about olive oil? Yes, olive oil is definitely considered to be a liquid. The situation that we're dealing with here is that it's... Who's the guy with the beard? Me? Yeah, okay. So, right, while this is going on, olive oil is absolutely a liquid. The issue that what we're talking about here is the... What's the word I'm looking for? The inadvertent liquid that's coming out of the olives as you're pulling it off the trees, and putting it into your container. So it may get a little bit liquidy or from the olive juice, from the olive oil. That's not considered olive oil. No one's going to use it anyway, etc. Oh man, I'm reading these puns in the chat box. Oh wow. Wow, wow, wow. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. Guys, keep it up. This is good stuff. Just so if you're listening to the audio or whatever, you want to know what's going on here, there are references to you're crushing it and press on. And yeah, that's what's going on. Okay, so let us continue. The point of the Talmudic passage here in Psachim is not about the difference between the olives and the grapes, per se. It's about how these two students phrase the question when they ask their teacher, what's the difference between the grapes and the olives? So pay close attention. I'm going to highlight again these two questions, okay? I just highlighted question number one. One of them said, due to what reason need one be careful to harvest grapes in a state of ritual purity by insisting on the use of pure vessels, and one not need harvest olives in a state of ritual purity? Notice in both halves of the question, the phrase that he uses is ritual purity. He talks about purity. And the other one said the same point, only he worded it differently. Here's the second form of the question. Due to what reason need one harvest grapes in a state of ritual purity, but one may harvest olives in a state of ritual impurity? So here the second student used the phrase impurity instead of purity. So the first rabbi, right? The first student says, why is this needed to be done with ritual purity? And that doesn't need to be done with ritual purity. He says purity twice. The second one says, why is this one needed to be done with ritual purity? And that one could be done in ritual impurity. He said the word impurity. Their teacher said, I am certain that this first student who spoke in a clean manner will issue halachic rulings in Israel. The Gemara adds, and it was not even a few days later that he issued halachic rulings in Israel. In other words, he saw the greatness of the individual who was so careful to speak in a clean manner that he said, I know that this student is going to become a great leader amongst the Jewish people. Okay. With me on this? The moral of the story is, speak nicely. We got to do the next story, which is fantastic. The Gemara relates an incident involving the use of appropriate language. Here we go. Here's another story. There were these three priests who walked into a bar. Oh, wait, sorry. That's the wrong story. There were these, back to the Talmud. There were these three priests in the temple, each of whom received a portion of the showbread divided among the priests. Let me give you a quick rundown. Every week, in the Holy Temple, they would have a stack of 12 loaves of bread placed in the building of the temple called the Kodesh, the Holies. And the bread was miracle bread, not miracle whip. That's what you put on bread. This is miracle bread that stayed fresh the entire week and never spoiled the whole week. At the end of the week, new bread was put on. the old bread was taken off, and the old bread, i.e. the bread that had been sitting there for a week, was divided amongst the Kohanim that served during that week. So the Kohanic families, the Kohanim, were they had shifts, and they worked for a week at a time. So the shift that left, they would take a portion of the showbread. Now you can imagine 12 loaves of bread divided by a whole shift of priests. It's not going to go that far. Everyone gets a little bit of bread, right? How much bread, you ask? Here we go. There were these three priests in the temple, each of whom received a portion of the showbread divided among the priests. Back inside. Since there were many priests, each one only received a small amount. One of them, one said to them, I received a bean-sized portion. And one said, I received an olive bulk. And one said, I received a portion the size of a lizard's tail. Yeah, which of these don't match the other? One says like a bean. One says like an olive. And the other one says like the tail of a lizard. There you go. All right, they investigated the background of the latter priest who used the imagery of an impure creeping animal, i.e. a lizard. And they found a trace, a shemetz, of disqualification in his background. Look at that. He used the language lizard's tail. They looked at his lineage and they found something. You know, there, the different commentators say what maybe they found. The Talmud certainly, because the Talmud doesn't want to get it. Listen, the Talmudic passage is talking about not digging up dirt, right? Not speaking negatively is not going to tell us, you know, what exactly this fellow's blemish was. But let it be known that they looked into this guy because he used such a strange and inappropriate expression regarding the showbread in the temple. It's very holy offering of this very holy bread. And this guy references it or relates it to a lizard's tail. They looked into him. They found something not so kosher in his background. Fine. That's the story. Now, by the way, you should know the Talmud continues to ask the question on a story. Right, the story was brought in the Talmud to teach us the importance of speaking nicely and not speaking not nicely. The Talmud continues to say, but wait, since when do we check lineage of Kohanim? If they're already working, we leave them be. So the Talmud essentially answers, yeah, but when a guy talks about lizard's tails, then you start digging. Then you start looking for something. That's kind of the next little piece of the Talmud. You can see here, I'm paraphrasing this a little bit. Look at the next, if you could see, do you see my mouse, the little pointer thing that's moving on? Yeah, you do see it? Okay, so look where it says the Gemara asks, but wasn't it taught in a Braita that one does not investigate a priest's lineage beyond the altar? In other words, once they start working, then you don't check anymore? And the answer is, look it over here. Okay, so the two answers, one answer is, do not say that they found the trace of disqualification, i.e. about his lineage, rather they found arrogance of disqualification. In other words, they found him to be arrogant, and that it alone was a disqualifying factor. And if you wish to say instead, there it is different as he casts aspersions upon himself. In other words, usually, this is the answer that I mentioned before, usually you don't investigate a Kohen. A Kohen's a Kohen. If they're already, if they've been accepted, that's it, they're accepted. We don't dig further, right? We're not digging up, skeletons in the old Kohanic closet.
Rabbi, wouldn't the Rebbe say how wonderful it is that he's 99% pure?
Yeah, but here, you know, this is, that's why we have a Rebbe, that's why we have a Chassidus. But then, you know, it's a little more hardcore. So they looked and they found something and that's it. You know, listen, you can't, it's the Rebbe's perspective was, you know, taking all of this and positive, what's the language? Not judging positively, that's like how it's phrased in Jewish law, but positive. Assume positive intent. Assuming positive intent, the Rebbe took that like to the max. You know, we had a story that we told recently at the Kiddush at Chabad in town. You know, when we used to be able to meet in person. So, so Rebbe Shishman told the story a few weeks ago about this fellow who comes to the Rebbe for dollars in the line of dollars for blessings. And he was of a different Hasidic group, and the Rebbe said, so what did your Rebbe teach recently? So he was saying how his Rebbe asked the question. The Talmud says that this, even the sinners of Israel have have many mitzvahs like a pomegranate has seeds. Like just like a pomegranate is filled with seeds, so too even the sinners amongst Israel have many mitzvahs. So he said, my Rebbe was asking, you know, if they have if they're sinners, how can they? What kind of mitzvahs are they doing? The Rebbe said to him, I also have a question on this Talmud, but the exact opposite. If they have so many mitzvahs, how are they called sinners? So again, you have a different way of completely understanding and looking at human behavior. But in this case, look, this guy spoke about lizards' tails. The next thing you know, they did an investigation and they pulled out the old, what's that hook that they use on stage? You know what I'm talking about? When they schlep people off stage because they're going too long? You know, they're making too long of a speech at the Oscars. All right, next, moving on. So what we're going to do now is we're going to skip a little bit. And because I want to get to some of the laws regarding the search for the chametz, because that's how the Mishnah begins. Although, again, the Mishnah begins with the word ar, light. And we have a whole pages about talking positively and all that good stuff. But I want to get into now the actual law regarding the checking for the chametz. So we're skipping. Okay, here we go. 4a, boom, right here. The Gemara, the Talmud returns to the issue of the search for leaven. So back on point, back to the search for chametz. Remember, when do we search for chametz? The night before the 14th or the eve of the 14th of the month of Nisan. The Seder is the next night, 24 hours later is the Seder. So 24 hours before is the search for chametz, the search for leaven. And now that we know, back inside, now that we maintain that everyone agrees that the word ar in the Mishnah is evening, consider the following. After all, both according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda and according to the opinion of Rabbi Meir, who disagree with regard to the deadline decreed by the sages to remove all leaven, it is prohibited to derive benefit from leavened bread by Torah law only from the sixth hour of the day and onward. And if so, let us search for leaven at 6 hours of the day and eliminate the leaven at that point. Let me explain. As we'll see soon, there's a dispute amongst the sages with regards to the timing of chametz on Erev Pesach, on the eve of Passover. When I say the eve of Passover, I mean from the day, like the day of, you know, the day eve of Passover. That's not making it any clearer. So, for example, the morning of that night will be the Seder. It's probably easier if we pull out a calendar. I wish I had a calendar handy. But let me actually open up a tab right here. Here we go. Let's do Jewish calendar 5780. Let's see what we can pull up right here. The magic of boom. Let's see. Is this Chabad? Chabad.org. Can't go wrong with Chabad.org. Okay. Instead of speaking theoretically, let's look at a calendar. Okay, here we go. We need the next month. Let's get to the next month. April 2020. Nisan 5780. Here we go. Now it's no longer theoretical. Now we actually have dates. Okay, the Seder is going to be Wednesday, April 8th at night. You see that where my where the little hand is? Okay, boom. April 8th at night is the Seder. Why? Because the next day is the 15th of Nisan, the 9th, and that's the eve of the 15th, i.e. the 15th starts at night, so it's Wednesday night. When do you check for chametz? You check for chametz the night before, right here. Tuesday night is when we check for chametz, because that's the eve of the 14th. So you check Tuesday night. Now, here's the question. You check chametz Tuesday night. What happens with the chametz that you find, right? And what happens, you know, what do you do with it? When do you get rid of it? When do you have to stop eating it? All of that happens Wednesday morning. Wednesday morning. But Wednesday morning when? When's the last time I can eat a bagel? What time? When? Wednesday when? Give me a time, right? So the Talmud is about to get into that. What time? When's the deadline? Up until when can you eat chametz? When do you have to get rid of it? When can you no longer own it? All of these time periods, that's what's going to be discussed. The question right now in the Talmud is very simple. The question is, if according to, let's go back to the Talmud, to the page of the Talmud. If according to both Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir,
yes.
Okay, it's prohibited to derive benefit from chametz only after the sixth hour of the day, which by the way, means midday, right? Noontime, which I'll explain in a moment. So if so, why are we looking for chametz the night before? Let me go back to my calendar. If according to all opinions, the deadline for deriving benefit from your chametz is Wednesday, midday, why are we checking for the chametz Tuesday night? Why are we looking for chametz the night before? What's the point? Look for it then. Look for it Wednesday morning. Why Tuesday night? Why then the eve of the 14th? Why not the morning of the 14th? So now, let me explain what it means, 6 hours. The way it works in Jewish law is that an hour is not necessarily 60 minutes. I know you're shocked. I know, Jewish time, right? An hour is not necessarily 60 minutes. How do you figure out an hour? Here's what you do. You calculate the number of daylight hours and divide it by 12. Are you with me? Okay, watch what I'm about to do. Look at the screen. Sunrise and sunset Atlanta. You ready? Boom. Let's see what's going on here. Wow. This is pretty symmetrical. Sunrise was 7:34. Sorry, this is for tomorrow. Sunrise will be 7:34 and sunset is 7:53. Are you with me on this? Okay. How many minutes is that? So that's 12 hours and how many minutes? 12 hours and 19 minutes, correct? Yes? 12 hours and 19 minutes. Okay, so let's pull up a calculator here. Okay, we're gonna do the math. We're not fooling around here. You have to know math to be a Talmudic scholar. Okay, check this out. So we have 12 times 60. 12 hours, 60 minutes equals 720 minutes plus another 19 minutes. So tomorrow, you will have 739 minutes of daylight, correct? You're with me on this so far? If sunrise is 7:34 and sunset is 7:53, according to my calculations, you have 739 minutes of daylight. Divide it by 12. Every halachic hour tomorrow is 61 and a half minutes, not 60 minutes. You with me on that? In Jewish law, you take the daylight hours, minutes, divided by 12, that's your hour. So when the Talmud says that after the sixth hour, you can no longer have benefit, what sixth hour? When sixth hour? How do you calculate? Easy peasy. You start at 7:34 and you count 6 hours. And every hour is not 60 minutes. Every hour is going to be 61.583 minutes. So you take 6 hours times 61.58. So watch this. Okay. So we have 61. Now times 6 hours equals 369 and a half minutes. So if you take 7:34 in the morning, 7:34 a.m., and add 369 and a half minutes to that, that's your 6 hours. Are you with me? Ish? At all? Did I lose you a calculator? Sorry. So basically, here's what I want you to know. What I want you to know is the Jewish time is not always The Jewish hour is not always 60 minutes. A halachic, a Jewish legal hour, is not always 60 minutes. In fact, it's usually not 60 minutes. Because either there's less than 12 hours in the day, or more than 12 hours in the day, daylight hours. Like again, tomorrow, you have 7:34 to 7:53. It's more than 12 hours. It's a little bit more, but it's more than 12 hours. And so that's how you calculate the hours. Getting back to the Talmudic passage, the Talmud says, I'll give you a very simple scenario. You with me? Let's cut out all the calculations and do a very simple scenario. Well, a few calculations left. Let's say sunrise is 6 a.m. and sunset is 6 p.m. So you have exactly 12 hours of daylight, and each hour is now an hour because it's exactly 12 hours, right? Good. So when is the sixth hour? Help me out. If sunrise is 6 and sunset is 6, what is my sixth hour? 12, right? Yes? 12? Yeah? 6 plus 6 is 12. So the 6th hour, 6 a.m. plus 6 hours is 12. Noon. But because it's not exactly 6 a.m. and because each hour is not exactly an hour, therefore we have differences. The point is, if anyway the time in which we're prohibited from deriving pleasure from our chametz is at the beginning of the sixth hour, which, by the way, the beginning of the sixth hour is not 12, it's 11 o'clock or 11:01, actually. That's the beginning of the sixth hour. At the end of 6 hours is 12, right? 6 plus 6, the end of that is 12. The beginning of 6 hours would be, again, before that. The point is, if you can't derive pleasure, benefit from the chametz at the sixth hour, wonderful, but you can start looking for your chametz that morning. Why do we bump it all the way back to the night before? That's the Talmudic question that we're at right now. Okay, so let's jump inside to the answer. Okay, the Talmud continues. Unless you say that this halacha is in accordance with the principle that the vigilant are early in the performance of mitzvot, in other words, maybe the reason why we look the night before is because we want to get a jump start. Yeah, you could have done it in the morning, but, you know, zrizin makdimin lemitzvah, so you want to really get an early start, so let's do it the night before. Then the Talmud asks, fine, you want to get an early start, good, then let's search in the morning. Don't wait to the sixth hour, search first thing in the morning. Why not get back to the night before? The principle, the vigilant, are early in the performance of mitzvot, is derived as it is written, and on the eighth day, this is from Leviticus regarding Brit Milah circumcision, it says, on the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised, and it was taught in a braita, the entire day is suitable for the mitzvah of circumcision. However, the vigilant are early in the performance of mitzvot and circumcised in the morning, as it stated with regard to the binding of Isaac, and Abraham arose early in the morning after hearing God's command. So again, the point of it is, where do we learn the concept of doing a mitzvah as early as possible? From the idea of Brit Milah. And then the mitzvah is, do it the morning of and not the night before. So the question is, why, when it comes to searching for chametz, even if you want it to be as early as possible, it should still be as early as possible on the day of the 14th, not the night before. So again, pulling up my calendar to reference in an actual date, the Talmud's question is very simple. Why are we looking for chametz the night of April 7th? We should do it first thing in the morning on April 8th, and you still have 6 hours to get rid of it after that. Or 6 hours after which you're prohibited to derive pleasure from it. You still have a bunch of hours left. You're fine. You're good to go. Why push it all the way back to the 7th at night? And if you want to say that we're trying to get a jump start means first thing in the morning. It doesn't mean the night before. As we derive from the laws regarding circumcision. I noticed that we had a chat. Let me see what's going on here. Okay. Yes. Correct. Right. We don't want to push off doing a mitzvah, so we do it as soon as possible. But again, that means that you do it in the morning. Why the night before? Okay. So now, let's go to the Talmud's answer. Talmud gives a beautiful answer. The Talmud, the Gemara, cites an answer to its initial question as of why the search for leaven is not conducted in the morning. Here we go. Two answers. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak said, one searches for leaven in the evening. Why? as it is a time when people are found in their homes. If you do it first thing in the morning, this one went to work already, this one went to school already, this one went shopping, everyone's out and about. Remember, this is certainly back in the day when people didn't have electricity. So at night, you know, in the day, everyone's out because you want to maximize your daylight hours. At night, everyone's typically at home. It's dangerous to be outside. There are no streetlights, etc. You're home. So the Talmud says, the Gemara says, why are we searching for chametz the night before the eve of Passover? Because you want to do it with company. You want to do it with everybody in the house present. It's a family activity to search for the chametz. Let's continue. And furthermore, second answer the Talmud, the light of the lamp is favorable for conducting a search specifically at night. As the search is conducted with a lamp, it is preferable to search at night. And I need to explain this. What the Talmud is saying is it's even preferable to search at night than in the day in order to find something. And to understand this, I need to shut the lights. No, I'm kidding. To understand this, I need to give you an illustration. Imagine it's pitch dark. It's pitch black. You can't see a thing. And all you have in your hand is one candle. And its glow is limited. It only illuminates right around the candle. How carefully are you searching? You're in every corner with your candle. You're looking at it with every detail, with every ounce of effort. Because it's very focused, it's a focused search. During the day, all the lights are on. I don't mean electricity. This was before electricity. The light, the windows, the shades are open. The light's pouring in from the sun. How carefully are you looking? You're looking, you're glancing around the room. You're not going into every corner like that. When there's no light, except for the one candle in your hand, you're going around and looking at it very methodically. So it's almost counterintuitive. If I would ask you, when's the best time to search for something? Day or night? You know, when it's light outside or when it's dark outside, you and I would say, obviously, when it's light outside. The Talmud is teaching us no. If you want to take a very peripheral look, a very, a glancy look, which is not a thing, not an adjective, but if that's the type of look that you want to do, then yeah, do it during the day. But if you want to take a deep dive, if you really want to inspect, it has to be at night, la'ar haner. With the light of the candle. That's how you really search detail in every corner, every crevice. By the way, it's a lesson in life also. You know, when you take, when you self-assessment or when you're really looking introspectively, when you look at everything, you see nothing. You have to look one thing at a time. You have to look at this one area and then another area and this corner and that corner, one thing at a time. Go slowly and methodically, and the darkness and the candle slow everything down. When it's light everywhere, things become very generalized. When there's no light and all you have is a little candle, it slows it down, and the slowing of the process allows us to go a little bit deeper and truly arrive at finding what it is that we need to find. Finding the chametz, as the Kabbalists explain, chametz is not just bread and croissants and baguettes and pizza and whatever it is, tam-tams, and what else? Animal crackers and wafers and chocolate chip cookies and pita bread, and I could go on. It's not only that, but chametz means the issues that we have inside. When I say issues, I mean the areas of fixing, the areas of correction, our ego, our anger, our jealousy, you know, all of our insecurities, right? All of the stuff that we have to work on. All of that stuff is is what we're meant to look within when we do Bedikas Chametz. I remember, I'll tell you a story, when I was a kid, I might have been Bar Mitzvah, but I wasn't either, it was before Bar Mitzvah or right after Bar Mitzvah. I was young, living in Pittsburgh, growing up in Pittsburgh. There was an older gentleman, I forgot his name, an older gentleman who needed help to do Bedikas Chametz, who needed help to search for Chametz, to search his house. He had a two-story house, not a small house, not a massive house. But he needed someone to go around because he was too old to do it himself. But he gave me instructions of how to do it. And I remember, it was the longest, I did it for a few years, I helped him out. Those were the longest searches for chametz You know, he was so methodical. He's like, no, you got to look in every single corner, every single, you know. It was a very slow process. It says, I think the Alter Rebbe would search for chametz and it would be an entire night. He would search the entire night. It wasn't about the bread. It wasn't about the 10 pieces of bread that he put out. It was about looking inside. It was about looking within. It was about discovering what it is inside that we need to that we need to get rid of. That's really what the search for chametz is on a spiritual level. But getting back to our conversation, which is the halacha question, again, a simple question in halacha. Simple question in Jewish law. Why do we search for chametz the night before? Why not the morning of? And the answer is, because it has to be dark outside. Why? That sounds worse. No. Because when it's dark outside, you're going to use a candle. And when you use a candle, or a lamp, the way it's referred to here, a lamp, I guess they didn't have candles, whatever, like a thing, right? When you use a candle lamp, then you know what? Then you're going to really look. You'll really find it. It really glows. It really illuminates. As opposed to all the light. Let's continue. Okay. Wow. This is fantastic. Look at the next statement from Abaye, one of the great Talmudic scholars. Abaye said, therefore, in light, all puns intended, of the above halacha, in light of the above law, a Torah scholar should not begin his regularly scheduled period of Torah study in the evening at the conclusion of the 13th of Nisan, that is the evening of the 14th. In other words, the night of the search for chametz, don't start studying Torah before you check. Why? As perhaps he will become engrossed in the halacha he is studying and will come to be prevented from performing the mitzvah of searching for leaven. In other words, since it's supposed to be done at night, but also what happens at night is people study Torah. So the Talmud says, good advice, don't begin your Torah study until you've already searched for your chametz. Because if you start studying Torah, you're going to get carried away. The next thing you know, it's going to be the morning and you'll have missed your opportunity. So if we didn't know that it needed to be at night, if it could also be the morning of, fine, even if you miss it the night of, you'll do it the next morning. But now that we said it needs to be done specifically at night, Abaye therefore says, oh, don't forget to do it. Set your alarm, set your iPhone, set your Android, set your Apple Watch, a call 411, I don't know if that still exists, and have them call you. Go to a hotel and have them call you from the front desk. Make sure, don't study Torah until you check your chametz, and that's how it rolls. Make sense? Yes? Okay, let me pause here for a moment. Any questions on any of what we talked about thus far, you can unmute yourself and ask away. Anybody? Questions, comments?
I have a question.
Yes.
So going back to the story of the...
One second. Hey, Karen. Just saying hi.
Hi.
Hey. All right. Go ahead.
Okay. Going back to the story of the Kohanim, that it's not a coincidence that story is interjected in this search for chametz. And so I'm just wondering if that's a bridge, you know, if you use kind of the spiritual connection of chametz and
right.
Looking inside and looking in the darkest, deepest places of our own, you know, our own exile and
yep.
and our own ego, there's got to be some bridge there because it's not there by accident.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. I think I love that idea, and I'm also thinking, you know. It's a good question to ask somebody, like, in those dark spaces, what comes out, right? In those moments of, like, what comes out? Is it a lizard's tail? Is it something else? What comes out in conversation? And that's how you can tell where somebody's at, what they're thinking, where they are, where their head is, right? It's in those moments of, you know, casual conversation when maybe not even the introspective moments, but in the moments of, you know, when people are not necessarily on guard, that's when things might come out. That's when you might be able to find out insight. And the point of the Bedikas Chametz, the point of searching for Chametz, like I said, is not just to clean the house of leaven, but to clean the inner house, to clean house internally. It's all. It's about the self repair. Yeah.
We started with being about meticulous in language, and this is about being meticulous in deed.
Love it. Love it. Yes. Yes. It's all about cleaning up shop. I love it. Okay, let's get into the next law. Take a look at this. You're going to love this. Such a good question. The Talmud asked this question. Before we get inside, don't look at the text. I mean, you can, but listen to me rather. Just because I, you know. No. So the question is like this. If you own a house, right? Now, not the year of the corona. In a normal year, when people can travel safely and freely, right? Let's say you have a house in Atlanta and you're going to Florida for Passover. Florida, right? And somebody else is going to rent, you're renting someone's house in Atlanta, in Florida. Someone else is going to rent your house in Georgia. So here's the question. Who has the obligation to search your house for chametz? Who searches your home the night of the 14th? Who's supposed to do it? The owner or the one who's leasing the house? So here we go. By the way, it's not only if you go away for the holiday. You know, let's say a more traditional sense. You own a house, but you don't live there. You rent it out. So who has the obligation to check for chametz? The owner or the renter? Let's jump inside. They raised the dilemma before the great Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak with regard to one who lets a house to another on the 14th of Nisan, which is the eve of Passover. Upon whom is it incumbent to search for leaven? Oh, no, this was like my example. I'm sorry. It was like my first example. So again, you own a house in Atlanta. You're going to Florida. Someone else has taken over your house for Passover. Mazel tov. You have Cheerios in the pantry, and you may have bread somewhere on the counter, whatever it is. Whose obligation is it to look for the chametz? Is it yours as the owner, or is it the new guy who's now renting it, and now for all intents and purposes for the next week and a half, it's his? So that's the question. Is it incumbent upon the lessor? The lesser means the owner, correct? Yes? Yes. Is it incumbent upon the lessor, in other words, the one who's leasing it out, to search for the leaven as the leavened bread is his? It's his bread. Or is it perhaps incumbent upon the lessee, the one who's leasing it now, to search as the source of the prohibition is in his domain since he will be living in the house during Passover? Again, somebody leases your house for Passover. Who is obligated to check? You or him? You, because it's your chametz. Go ahead.
I'm going to get it wrong, but who wants to be known as a crummy landlord?
I want to say this. Steve, you've outdone yourself again. Sometimes, you know, your jokes are a little bit stale, but this, but that one was great. That was great. Not crusty at all. Okay. Yes. All right. Yes. It's a lot of fun over here. Okay.
Let's see is my vote.
Let's see what?
The person renting is my vote.
Okay. Oh, you say, you're actually getting back to the Talmud. All right. Fine. Okay. If you insist, let's jump back into it. Okay.
You lend a good with the presumption that it's fit for use.
Ah, okay. Good. All good points. Let's look at the Talmud. He answered, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak answered, come in here and answer from a Braita. Oh, I love it. So the way the Talmud wants to do this, the way the rabbi wants to do this is using another source that might shed light on this question. So he used the example of a mezuzah. So he says, listen to another teaching. With regard to one who lets a house to another, the obligation is upon the lessee to affix a mezuzah for it. So simple case. If you are renting a home, if you lease a home to someone else, so they're renting it from you, who puts up the scroll? You, the owner, or them, the lessee, the renter? The Braita says, the Braita was like a Mishnaic era teaching, so it's an earlier teaching that has a lot of halachic validity. So the Braita says, the obligation, it says straight up, the obligation is upon the lessee to put the mezuzah. The renter puts the mezuzah. Apparently, the Talmud concludes, the person renting the house is obligated to perform mitzvah connected to the house. So if you have to put, if you the renter, puts up the mezuzah, so then you should also check for the chametz, you would think, but not so fast. The Gemara rejects this proof and says, not a good proof. You can't draw the inference from mezuzah to chametz searching. Why? Because there, in the case of mezuzah, didn't Rav Misharshia say affixing a mezuzah is an obligation of the resident? There's a specific case by the mezuzah. Case? By the mezuzah? The mezuzah is a specific case. What's the case? It's that the obligation is only on the person living there, not the person owning the house. If you own an empty house, you have no obligation to put up a mezuzah. The mezuzah only kicks in, the obligation for mezuzah only kicks in when you live there. Therefore, who's living there? The owner or the renter? The renter. So when it comes to mezuzah, obviously the renter puts up the mezuzah because the owner has no obligation to put one up if they're not living there. So again, the fact is that the owner of an uninhabited house back inside is not obligated to fix a mezuzah on its doors. So by mezuzah is an exception. Mezuzah is a very specific case where the obligation is not in the house, it's on the person who's dwelling there right now. So if the renter is dwelling there, then it's his mezuzah. He's on the hook for the mezuzah. That's a specific case. Our question is not about mezuzah. The question is about chametz. Chametz is not an obligation on the person living there, or maybe it is. We don't know. That's our question. What is who does the chametz? Who searches for the chametz? Nachman bar Yitzchak said to him, let's continue. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak said to him that we already learned a resolution to this dilemma in a braita. So he brings another source that's clear. Not from mezuzah, but straight up from the chametz itself. And it says in a braita. Now, why didn't he say this one right away? I don't know. But this is the one that's the definitive proof. It says, one who rents a house to another, if before... Okay, let me say this again. One who rents a house to another, if before he delivered... Oh, because it's also not exactly... Okay, but it's good enough. One who rents a house to another, if before he delivered the keys to the renter, the 14th of Nisan began, the obligation is upon the lessor to search for leaven. And if it was after he delivered the keys to him that the 14th began, the obligation is upon the lessee to search for leaven. So here we have a clear proof that says actually it is like the mezuzah. And that is like this. So let's say you make an agreement on the 10th day of Nisan that you're going to rent the house for Passover, but you haven't delivered the keys. And in Jewish law, delivering the keys is a key component to the transfer of the actual, you know, dwellership. Like, who's actually dwelling there? You can't dwell there without the keys, right? So if he hasn't given the keys over to the renter, and it's the night of the 14th, he has to do it himself. The owner has to do it. So you're the owner, again, keeping the same scenario. You're the owner, and Yankel Shmerel Beryl is the renter. Yeah, he has a few names. It's fine. So you're the owner. Yankel Shmerel Beryl is renting it from you. You haven't given Yankel Shmerel Beryl the keys. It's the night of the 14th. You still have the keys. So who does it? Who does Bedikas Chametz? Who searches? You. Well, first of all, you're the owner with the keys to the house, but also because it's still yours on some level because the other one hasn't assumed ownership or assumed dwellership. But if you've delivered the keys to him before, then who does it? Yankel Shmerel Beryl. And we don't say, but wait, it's your chametz, not Yankel Shmerel Beryl. No, you gave it to Yankel. Yankel Shmerel Beryl is renting it. You gave him the keys. It's the 14th. Now it's on him. That is the halacha. You with me on this? So again, to be very clear here, this is a very practical case. It's asked every single year. Oh, well, except for, again, this year is an exception because people aren't...
But Ari, it says after the 14th. So it says that you have to assume that your fellow Jew...
No. And if it was... No, look what it says here. And if it was after... after he delivered the keys to him that the 14th began. So in other words, if you gave him the keys and then it was the night of the 14th,
then it's his.
Now again, this is such a practical case. Listen to the situation. Let's say, I'm going to give a different scenario than before, but work with me on this. Let's say, and this happens all the time. People go down to Florida. Florida's a huge destination. We've gone down to Florida, for a few years also. When some of the years that we're out of town from Atlanta, we go down to Florida. We've gone to other places. We went to New York last year, whatever. So let's say you're going down to, I don't know, Orlando. And you're renting a villa in Orlando, right? Theoretically. And so you come in. Let's say you come in day 13. Right, the 13th of Nisan. So let's pull up our calendar. So that would be, right here, the 7th. Tuesday morning, you arrive. You get your keys. Oh, beautiful place. Ready for the holiday. Comes the night of the 7th of April, which is the eve of the 14th. And now it's a mitzvah to check for chametz. Who's checking? So you might say, I should check. I just got here. Well, I didn't bring any chametz with me. I don't have any Cheerios. What am I checking? I don't own anything here. So who checks? The Talmud says, the halacha is, the law is, you have to check. You have to check. If you're there, if you're renting the place and you're there, you have to check. So what do? You put out some bread, you put it around the house, and you check. You have an obligation to check where you are. If you're renting it, you have to check where you are. That's it. Now, we ask another question, the Talmud continues. They raised another dilemma before of Nachum Bar Yitzchak. Now, this is a case where you only rented the house the morning of the 14th, i.e. the morning after the checking of the chametz. That's when you walk in. Now the question is, another question, can you assume that the guy did it the night before? Or should you have to do it again? In other words, do you assume that the owner followed Jewish law and did it, correctly the night before, or should you do it now, makeshift, the morning of? Not ideally, but should you do it now? So again, let's just read this question. I'll give you the answer. They raised another dilemma before Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak with regard to one who lets a house to another on the 14th, not the night before, the day before, but on the 14th, which is Erev Pesach itself. Is its presumptive status that it has been searched, or is it not its presumptive status that has been searched? In other words, you walk in the morning of the 14th. Now, the search for the chametz was the night before. Do you walk in and say, I'm sure he did it? Or do you do a makeshift the morning of? Not ideal, but you got to do it anyway because it wasn't done. So better late than never. What's the deal? Now, the Gemara asked the obvious question. What's the practical difference between these possibilities? Just ask the owner. Let him ask the owner of the house. Like, who cares? Just ask the guy, did you do it or not? The Gemara responds, the situation here is where the owner is not here to ask. The dilemma is whether or not to impose upon the renter to search for the leaven. What's the halacha? So the Gemara, it's amazing. Because in the times of the Gemara, it was a stronger question than it is today. We know with Airbnbs, you can rent a house and have zero interaction. I mean, I guess there is a way to communicate, but it's possible to rent things remotely and maybe not be able to find out the answer to that question. Did they do bedikas chametz or not? Did they search for the chametz or not? And so in the times of the Talmud says, just ask the guy, and we have to say, no, the guy's not around, and maybe that was a far-fetched scenario. Today, we can understand, the owner's not around. You're dealing with an agent in between, and you don't know if the owner did it before or not. And there's no way to get in touch. He's in the Bahamas. They're gone. They're out of touch. Ooh, cell phone's off. So now what? What do you do? You're stuck. It's now, getting back to our calendar, let's just put it in an actual timeline. So it's now Wednesday morning, the 8th, the 14th day of Nisan. You walk in 8 a.m., to a house that you're renting for Passover. What's the status? Checked or unchecked? Ask the guy. You can't ask the guy. He's not around. What's the presumption? We don't have time to go into the Gemara, into the entire discussion back and forth. The conclusion is, hold on, let me just confirm. The conclusion is, here we go, with regard to all houses on the 14th, their presumptive status is that they have already been searched. That's what it is. You assume that the Jew followed halacha, that they followed Jewish law, and he did it. Now, if he tells you that he didn't, then you know. But if you don't know, assume the best. Assume the positive, that it was checked, and you don't check it again. So what's the final note of tonight? It's assume positive intent. So we come, right? Right, we're coming full circle. All of the themes are about positivity. Speak positive. Be introspective. You know, look at the things that we have to repair, but from a place of positivity with the light of the candle. And if it's in your possession, you got to search for it, even if you're the renter. And if you don't know, assume that it was done. And that's how we conclude tonight's session. All right, we have another, how many more sessions do we have? Thank you. So just a little bit of looking at the calendar. What's today? Today's the 24th. So next Tuesday is the 31st and then the 7th. So we have another two sessions for this. Oh, actually, no. The 7th is going to be the night of checking the chametz. So we have one session next time. And then the week after that, the 7th, is when we're actually going to put into practice what we're talking about. We're going to look for the chametz. And next week, I'll make sure that we talk in a very practical way about how to do it and how to even have fun doing it. So we'll explore that and how to not burn down anything that shouldn't be burned down while doing it. So join me next week, same bat time, same bat channel for Talmud Tuesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay. Any questions before we close out? Questions, yes, comments?
A Zoom Seder, since it's a day of no work, from the first and the last day of Pesach, then a Zoom Seder?
No. We can do a Zoom model Seder. Assuming we can find model. I don't know. I mean, we could do theoretically like a mock Seder beforehand, but the actual Seder, no. Also, if we do it on Zoom, it's going to go too fast.
I sent you a halacha that came from one of the Israeli sites this morning.
Yeah.
And they're saying that it might be kosher if you turn it on ahead of time.
Wait, I didn't see that. You sent it to me?
I sent it to you, yeah.
I got to look at that. Okay. Interesting. I haven't seen that. Clearly haven't seen that. But I will take a look at that. It sounds interesting.
You did see that after every stage of the Seder, you have to do Orchatz.
Orchatz, yeah. Kadesh Orchatz, Karpas Orchatz, Yachatz Orchatz. Yeah, that's the joke. Step two is washing the hands, but you do that after each step this year. Yeah. I'll tell you this, but Corona, since it's a beer, is not kosher on Pesach. So by
potato Corona.
Well, no traces of Corona. We have to get rid of the chametz, get rid of this plague that's terrible situation. So everyone should have health, and everyone who needs a refuah shlema, healing, should have a healing, a full healing, a very quick healing, and we should only have good news from here on out.
Amen.
It's great to see you all. Tomorrow, noon, 12 o'clock, we have Power Parsha. Tomorrow night, 7:30, Passover boot camp / Torah studies, 7:30 p.m. tomorrow night. Be there or be square. All right, we'll see you all. Take care. Laila Tov. Laila Tov. Pleasure.
David, I miss you.
Pleasure. See you. I know, I say pleasure.